is Mark Sandelow, Associate Academic Director at the University of California's Washington Center and editor of the California News Service. He's also the author of Madam Speaker, The Life, Times, and Rise of Nancy Pelosi. Mark Sandelow, good morning, and thanks for joining me.
Good morning, John.
Eventually, I want to get to the discussion of Nancy Pelosi's legacy as Speaker of the House, but I'd like to start with how she got there in the first place. How did Nancy Pelosi get started in politics?
She was born right into it. You know, people think of Pelosi as this San Francisco socialite, but her roots are actually East Coast. It's Baltimore's Little Italy. When she was born, her dad was a member of the House of Representatives, representing an ethnic Italian area from Baltimore. He left the House of Representatives to serve as mayor of Baltimore. Her whole life was as a political child. Her dad was Tommy D'Alessandro. If Central Casting could have picked a guy to, you know, with the dapper kerchief in the pocket and the suit and the fedora on, the kind of guy who you'd expect to burst into a smoke-filled room and see, that was Tommy D'Alessandro. So she always lived with this. She came down to college in Washington, D.C., despite her father not wanting her to go that far from home, you know, full 50-minute drive, and met a guy who was going to school at Georgetown, Paul Pelosi. He was a San Franciscan. She lived on the East Coast for a while, returned to San Francisco as Nancy Pelosi, and slowly moved her way up through the Democratic ranks. She was actually director or chairman of the California Democratic Party, sort of an inside operative position. The first office she ever ran for was in 1987 when San Francisco's Congresswoman Sally Burton died, and she ran for the seat, and she's held it ever since.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because she held, as you said, a number of posts in party politics in the Democratic Party in the state of California. Why wait until 1987 to run for elective office, and then why start with Congress?
Well, it's partly because family. Nancy Pelosi had five children in 6 years, which, you know, anyone who's had kids, I think, makes their body ache just to think about. She had, you know, when she moved to San Francisco, although she came from this political background, I mean, she at one point, I mean, anybody who has children understands that when you have five little kids in a six-year period, you're consumed with other things. I don't think it ever occurred to her to actually run for office herself, but, you know, as a little girl, having, you know, leafleted for her father, she always thought she'd be involved in politics, but she saw herself as an organizer, as a staffer. She had fundraisers, which made her extremely popular with California politicians, folks like Jerry Brown, who was rising up to become governor of California. Even folks like, you know, Ted Kennedy would come out from the East Coast and raise money at Nancy Pelosi's house in San Francisco. So when the seat opened up, she was a natural in that she could raise the money. She had some name recognition within the party, and the party thought she'd be perfect. She actually ran against the guy who would have been the first openly gay man to have ever been elected as a gay man to the House of Representatives, Harry Britt. He was part of, he was a Harvey Milk accolade for anybody who knows San Francisco politics and, you know, the slain city supervisor. And it was a very, very close election. The liberal establishment in San Francisco and the gay establishment lined up behind Harry Britt. Pelosi was seen at that point as the party girl, which was both a derisive thing, meaning she holds a lot of fundraisers, but also because she was the Democratic Party establishment. It was an extremely close race. But that was, you know, that was 20-some years ago, and she has not had even close to a close election ever since.
I was going to say, that is has turned out to be probably the safest seat in the House of Representatives over the years. I mean, she generally wins with about a 70% majority.
Well, you know, let me just correct that for a moment, John, because for years I covered her San Francisco Chronicle. I was the bureau chief out here in Washington, and I would say to her something like, well, you know what, you won with 80%. She always cut me off 82%, Mark. She counted those votes. She always wanted to be above 80%. And the first time she didn't get over 80% was just two elections ago as Speaker of the House. Why? Because her constituents in San Francisco were frustrated with the compromises she made, didn't think she was liberal enough, and she only then got something like 75% of the vote.
Yeah, and it wasn't. Didn't she get a challenge from an independent, Cindy Sheehan? Nancy Pelosi refused to go along with the idea of impeaching President Bush.
That's right. It was impeaching President Bush, and you know, Nancy Pelosi has probably been the most vocal, consistent critic of the war in Iraq. She was dead set against the war in Iraq before it started, and when Democratic leaders like Dick Gephardt went with President Bush and actually went to the White House for ceremonies to commemorate Congress giving him the authority to go to war in Iraq, Pelosi broke with the Democratic leadership and said, this is wrong, there's no proof of weapons of mass destruction. She was very, very anti-war. So when she becomes a speaker, the thought was, and remember, Bush was still president, now the House can do something about it. So they passed a resolution calling on Bush to set a timeline to get out of Iraq. Not surprisingly, Bush vetoed that resolution. And so the call was from the left, first of all, you can impeach Bush, and the other thing you can do, since Congress holds the purse strings, just defund the Pentagon. Give the Pentagon zero money, or give the war not a dollar more than it takes to pull the troops out. The president can't veto that. I mean, the money comes from Congress. Pelosi wasn't willing to go that far. She said, essentially, that's not good politics. It's also not good for the troops. And the left was very angry that she wouldn't go that further step.
Well, let's step back a minute. Well, she got into Congress in the special election in 1987. And by 2001, she was the House Minority Whip. Talk about her path to that position in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, she came to the House and to Washington in an elevated spot in that she was this prominent fundraiser from California. You know, she knew people. She says that when she first got to Washington in 87 as a freshman, she figured she already knew half of the Democrats in Congress on a first-name basis. So she was already an inside player. And, you know, the opportunity, it's these things where it just lines up. There's been 12,000 members of Congress in history, and 51 of them have been speakers so far. It's something all these people in Washington, and when you work with them, you can see this. They've all been class presidents or valedictorians or chairmen of their city councils or mayors. The world has revolved around them. It's not a shy, egoless kind of place. So they all picture themselves as being the boss. You come to the House of Representatives, you're one of 435. It's a humbling experience. It just, the stars lined up, and the California's leader in House leadership was a guy who left Congress in the mid-90s, and she suddenly saw a path. If she could get the Californians behind her, because California is huge. There are 34 members of Congress, Democrats from California. The delegation is actually 53 members. If she could get Democrats behind her, she could get the left behind her, and she could get women behind her, she had a pretty clear shot of rising up to the top of the Democratic ranks. And what she had going for her, too, was, you know, the old-fashioned political way of rising. She had money, not only personal money, but she raised an incredible amount of money. She traveled the country. She was very well connected to, you know, Northern California is a very wealthy place. Not as wealthy today as it was maybe 10 years ago, but the combination of Silicon Valley and real estate in Northern California. And there aren't really competitive seats out there. Like you point out, Pelosi wins by these huge amounts. What that means is she can raise that money from wealthy Bay Area people and distribute it around the country. So she traveled the country giving money to, you know, candidates in Wisconsin. And, you know, so when Tammy Baldwin gets to Congress, if Nancy Pelosi has helped raise money for her, you know, Representative Baldwin is quite appreciative of that. So she has friends all around the country. And that's what, you know, she had a, it was a pretty intense battle because there are the number two person in the Democratic ranks now, Steny Hoyer from Maryland. If you looked at his face, you could almost cut it out and put it in the portraits on Capitol Hill. He looks like a Speaker of the House. If you looked at all the caricatures of speakers, that's what he looks like. It's what he's always wanted to be. And, you know, here comes this woman from San Francisco. So actually he and her had a long battle to assume this top Democratic position, but she triumphed, and then it was just a matter of waiting until Democrats took control, which she helped to orchestrate in 2006.
So she comes into Congress, and she has all these things going for her. Becomes the minority leader under Dick Gephardt. He goes on to run for president. She became the minority whip, then she became the first woman to be a minority leader in the House of Representatives when Dick Gephardt leaves to go run for president.
Right.
This is a time when the Democrats have been out of power in the House of Representatives for a while. How did she use that time then to position herself and position her party to retake that chamber?
So Republicans were overjoyed when this happened. I recently looked through some of those clips from back then. This is in 2001, 2000. It was actually right at, well, it's 2001, 2002, shortly after the September 11th attacks. And Republicans, a headline of some articles, are the Democrats about to become the stupid party? Have Democrats gone insane? Please elect Nancy Pelosi. Pelosi will keep Republicans in the majority for generations to come. Because when people looked at Pelosi, she's not a very articulate woman. She really is a terrible public speaker. And she's from San Francisco. She is a liberal and a partisan through and through. And they assumed automatically that this, high society woman from San Francisco, this lefty, must be this sort of wide-eyed latte liberal who would take the Democrats off the cliff. And what they didn't understand about Pelosi is, she was Nancy D'Alessandro, was her maiden name, from Little Italy. She was a behind-the-scenes operative. It is true that she's not a good speaker. It's true she's a liberal, but she never led as an ideologue. She's a pragmatist. She wants to get things done. And what she did was very carefully and systematically go around the country and figure out where swing districts were located and find candidates who didn't necessarily reflect San Francisco values, didn't necessarily reflect Madison values, but were Democrats who could reflect the conservative values of these swing districts. So people like Heath Shuler, who is not in favor of expanding gay rights, he's pro-gun, he's pro-life, former quarterback for the Washington Redskins, they got him to run in North Carolina as a Democrat because he is fiscally, he's still sort of he associates more with Democrats than Republicans. It's not the kind of person you would picture to be close to Nancy Pelosi, but they got enough of these people that they captured the center, and it took a lot of Republicans by surprise. They assumed she would be an ideologue. They assumed she would waste her time impeaching the president, holding hearings to impeach the president, or angering voters by cutting off funds to the Pentagon. She didn't do that. She positioned herself as a leader, as a centrist and a pragmatist. And as the public turned on George Bush and the public turned against the war in Iraq, she was in the right place, and Democrats swept in with pretty big majorities for the last couple sessions.
We'd like to invite everybody to join the discussion. This morning, we're talking about the legacy of Speaker of the House of Representative Nancy Pelosi. She's had a four-year run as the first woman ever to hold the post of Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. And we're going to talk about some of the things that were accomplished in Congress while she was leading the House, and other aspects of her career as well. We've kind of been talking about how she got there to sort of set this conversation up. Here's how you join in. The phone number is 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook fan page and leave a comment there, and then I'll see that it gets on the radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Almost 22 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. After 3 on Here on Earth, Jean Faraca and her guest talk about the riches of international children's literature. That's after 3 today, here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about Nancy Pelosi, who will be leaving the post of Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States Congress at the end of the year, going back to a post that she held before becoming Speaker, which is House Minority Leader. And we're going to be talking in this hour about her legacy. What she leaves behind is a record of accomplishment as Speaker of the House. And my guest is Mark Sandelow, who is Associate Academic Director at the University of California Washington Center and editor of the California News Service. He's also the author of Madam Speaker, the life, times, and rise of Nancy Pelosi. Well, just before the break, we were talking about Nancy Pelosi sort of fooled the Republicans. They believed one thing about her, and then she gave them something else once she really started to go to work. I thought it was interesting that in the run-up to the 2006 election, which is when the Democrats retook Congress, she basically said that impeachment was off the table. I mean, she said, look, when we come in, if we take the majority, this is not what we're going to be doing. I mean, she wasn't shy about it. And at the time, it seemed like a rather unpopular decision because the Democrats really wanted George Bush's head on a platter.
It was unpopular, in places like San Francisco and Madison and Boston. But, Democrats were going to win those seats in those places, regardless of whether she said that or not. And I think that it was not popular there, but she knew that, first of all, there's a practical piece of it. If the Democrats went for impeachment, and really there were people who were practically gaming this out, it would take at least a year to go through the whole process of calling a committee and holding hearings and gathering evidence and getting a prosecutor. So now we're into 2007. At best, if you're a Democrat, at best, you succeed in impeaching the President of the United States. There's a trial in the Senate. And in early 2008, in its final year of office, he finally gets thrown out. And who replaces him? Dick Cheney. It doesn't accomplish anything, is her view. And politically, clearly, it was something that she thought that moderate voters would think that this is crazy. Why are we voting in a vindictive party? And why not a party that's going to move forward on legislation? And she well remembered Newt Gingrich, who campaigned on his pledge in 1998 that we're going to impeach President Clinton. And for the Republicans lost seats. And in fact, Gingrich left a few days after the 1998 election because Republicans had done so poorly. They went on in a lame duck session to go ahead and impeach President Clinton, but it wasn't something that was particularly popular, and I don't think she wanted to repeat that mistake.
We have an email from Bob in Monona. Does Nancy Pelosi see herself as a model to other women? Has she spoken to women's groups or high school students about this?
Yeah, this is a big part of what she sees it. I think she has accomplished that, and rightfully so. I mean, she is, I mentioned there are 51, she's the 51st Speaker of the United States. There have been 8 Johns, 4 Josephs, there's even been a Newt as Speaker, never a Nancy. And in fact, of those 12,000 people who served in Congress in American history, this is sort of shocking. Grand total of about 300 of them have been women. That's it. We're talking, 2%. And so she really has shattered not only the marble ceiling, she likes to call it, but a stereotype. Because when you think of the Speaker of the House, at least a few years ago, you think of like this craggy-faced guy like Tip O'Neill, or you think of Sam Rayburn, who they named buildings after, who was a short guy who could make your collar wilt by the way he would talk to you. And, here comes this woman who has a story unlike any of the others. And, she's a mother, she's a grandmother, and it changes the view. And the result is, partly because, I wrote a book on Nancy Pelosi, my kids, I've got teenage boys, they don't think twice about, Speaker of the House, petite woman from San Francisco, craggy-faced man from Boston. It's all the same to them. That's a remarkable change in, just a matter of a few years. And she does speak to women's groups. And, what she likes to say, and I don't know how much this is politically calculated or not, she likes to talk about the fathers who come up to her and say, thank you on behalf of my daughters, because our daughters, now look up and see that they can become, Speaker of the House. And, I'm not sure how many fathers actually come up and say that to her, but clearly this is something that's very meaningful to her.
Here's another email. That's our morning for emails. That's a good thing. Email from Bonnie in Madison, who says, we need more tough Democrats like Nancy Pelosi. Compare her with another tough speaker, Newt Gingrich, who is said to have ordered Republican House members to not socialize with Democrats. Compare her leadership style with that of Newt Gingrich.
Newt Gingrich was a visionary. Now, I'm not trying to say his vision was in a good place, But he was a guy who looked 20 years down the road and tried to view where American society fits in and the place of Republicans and the place. That's not Nancy Pelosi. I mean, going back to her roots for a moment, you know, when she was 12 years old, they had something called the favor file. Constituents would come to the D'Alessandro home where her dad was mayor, and they would say things like, you know, I need my street light repaired, or my sewage isn't working, or my brother's in jail, you know, things he asked the mayor to help out with. She was trained as a 12-year-old to put down their names on this little index card. First you get their name, you get their telephone number, you find out what they want, and then you put it in this little box. It was like a recipe box they had in the kitchen. And then you try to hand it off to the staff and see if they can do something about it. But the reason they kept this was because come election day, you have a list of people who now owe you a favor. They call it the favor file. You need somebody to drive elderly voters to the polls, somebody to put signs in their windows. You got a box of this. That's the kind of politics Nancy Pelosi does. Newt Gingrich doesn't do that. He's the big thinker and the big talker. Pelosi doesn't, that's not her style. She is the backroom, arm-twisting person who, you know, orchestrates how you get legislation passed when there are all these conflicting coalitions that are trying to push for it. In that sense, I think that John Boehner, people will see, is much more in the Nancy Pelosi style, the incoming Republican. Of course, he's conservative. He's every bit as conservative as Pelosi was liberal. But unlike Gingrich, that's not his main calling. His main calling is to try to move legislation. He also is a backroom operator, very, very different from the Newt Gingrich style.
More of a ward politician than the orator and the showman.
Absolutely.
Well, you've actually started to answer a question that I was going to pose about Nancy Pelosi's leadership style as the speaker. The Democrats can be a pretty fractious bunch. I mean, one of the things that's been interesting from a purely political perspective to watch over the last 20 to 25 years is the difference in party discipline between the Republicans and the Democrats. The Democrats, boy, I'll tell you what, sometimes it's looked like trying to herd cats or a circular firing squad. The Republicans have been able to maintain pretty decent party discipline, both when they've been in the majority and when they've been the minority party. Talk about Nancy Pelosi's leadership style and how she was able to keep those House Democrats, that fractious bunch of free thinkers, in line.
Partly she used the power she had, even when she was minority leader, you know, and the powers that you have over your party members include things like committee assignments, who gets their name on certain pieces of legislation, fundraising dollars. This is the bread and butter of people who serve in the House. It's very important. And she's very mindful in a very tactic-oriented way of when, say, conservative Democrats can't vote for liberal items. She understands you can't vote against your district and expect to return to Congress. At the same time, she would call in chips, and she was unabashed about telling people, you stick with us or your committee assignment is at risk. And, you know, members would go off to do their own personal fundraising and risk party accomplishments, she would warn them, you know, this could cost you your seat on the budget committee. She very early on cited, it was actually John Dingell in Michigan, who's very, very conservative, the dean of the House. He actually came to Washington when Nancy Pelosi was only a teenager. And he got shoved into a district after redistricting in Michigan, a district that represents Dearborn, conservative blue-collar workers, and Ann Arbor, you know, University of Michigan liberals, along with a woman named Lynn Rivers, who was a classic liberal member. And they had a primary against each other. Dingell was the establishment candidate. Pelosi gave $10,000 as a contribution. This is when she was the whip, so she was in leadership, to Lynn Rivers. And people said, oh, my God, this is a rookie mistake. What are you doing? You don't get involved in intra-party fights. This is a terrible thing. It wasn't a mistake. I mean, this was hardball politics. Dingell had not been with her. Dingell supported Steny Hoyer for leadership positions. Rivers was with Pelosi. Pelosi wanted to send the message she supports her friends, and she helps her friends. And she was very, very tough in this way. And for at least, you know, 7 or 8 years, there was remarkable unity among Democrats. And, you know, I mentioned guys like Heath Shuler. There were a ton of these folks. There were folks in southern Indiana, Democratic congressmen, who folks in, you know, I came at Madison to San Francisco, won't even recognize as Democrats. These are conservatives, but they're more Democratic than they are Republican. And she kept them in the same party without big, noticeable fights with people like Barbara Lee, the representative from Berkeley, you know, with Tammy Baldwin, with David Obie, who whose fiscal policy is a whole lot different than the conservatives were. And we saw just in the last couple months now the Democrats have had a bad spell. For the first time, we're beginning to see some real splits in that. I mean, Heath Shuler, who I've mentioned a few times, he ran against Nancy Pelosi to be the top Democrat just a few weeks ago. He didn't win, but out of I think the vote was 150 to 40-something. The fact that there were 40 people, it was a secret ballot, but the fact that there were 40 people still willing to vote against Nancy Pelosi is something we haven't seen before. And it suggests that, you know, ultimately what Democrats want is a winner. And as long as she's leading them to the promised land of a majority, they're willing to stick behind her. And, you know, from the left to the right, they'll do that. The minute she stops winning, we're going to start to see this circular firing squad, as you called it, come right back out.
We have another email from Kay in Milwaukee. Kay writes, it seems that part of the Democrats' problem is that they want to be tolerant and accommodating to many different people. As a result, the party has a hard time staying together and finding a voice to combat the more unified front of the Republicans. Nancy Pelosi seems less of an accommodationist than other Democrats. Does she see herself that way? Would the Democrats be better off if they were more hardline and liberal like Nancy Pelosi?
Well, it's an excellent point, and it's really catch-22, which is argued about every day on Capitol Hill. Yes, you could be more, some would call it dogmatic, some would call it principled, about Democratic values. We are not going to compromise on things. And this tax fight that just went on is a perfect example. Why are we giving tax cuts to the rich? And if the Democrats want to stand by that, they can. The problem is, they're not going to be a majority party that way. And, you know, Pelosi used to meet with the freshman members of Congress who are much more conservative, because, as I mentioned, they go out to these conservative districts and get centrist Democrats. But she called them the majority makers because they were the ones who put her in the speaker's position. And if it weren't for their accommodations and their big tent, they wouldn't be a majority party. And Pelosi's had this sort of interesting, you know, fine line she walks, because she is a liberal. In the 25 years she's been in the House, the only vote I can think of where she angered the left, she voted in favor of NAFTA back in the early 90s. But she is a consistent, true liberal. But that said, she is an accommodationist, although, boy, she would never use that word, when it comes to being willing to, you know, open the doors to more conservatives. I always thought it would be interesting to take a look at the liberal, wealthy Democrats in California who give Pelosi money, to see where that money is spent, because it's not spent on Pelosi getting reelected. She doesn't need to run TV campaigns. It goes to districts like those in North Carolina and Indiana, to elect people who I think some Northern California Democrats might be horrified by. Nevertheless, it empowers them, and it gives the Democrats a majority, which allows them to do things like pass a health care bill, as compromised as it may have been, that otherwise never would have gotten to the president's desk.
Well, you said it. You said it earlier, Mark Sandala, that Nancy Pelosi is ultimately a pragmatist. She believes in what works, and when pragmatism trumps ideology, that's when things actually get done.
And there's a debate on that. I mean, that's absolutely, that's the point I made, and it's the point that those people who are big fans, I think, would make. The other side to that, of course, is if you accommodate too much, you never stake out a position. And if Americans aren't ready for, say, a public option in the health care bill, well, you've got to go out there and say, sorry, that's what we got to have. And you've got to go out there for a year or two and push and push and push you push outside the envelope so that eventually the rest of the country comes your way. If you accommodate too much, people think that the center is the place to be. So that's the flip side of it. But clearly Pelosi is on the side of getting things done, even if some compromise is necessary.
We're starting to get some phone calls now. Still a couple of lines available for you if you'd like to join the discussion. We're talking about the legacy of Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House of Representatives. This isn't a eulogy of any kind. I don't want to give the impression we're eulogizing Nancy Pelosi, but we are talking about her legislative career to this point. And I want to spend some time the rest of the hour talking about what she's going to be remembered for as the Speaker of the House. Let's go to the phones. We'll start in Monona, and we'll talk to Rick this morning. Rick, good morning.
Good morning. I am enjoying your program. I think Nancy Pelosi is one of the most effective speakers, I think, probably in the last 30 years or so. I've never seen anybody that could get so many bills passed so quickly, and she was so far ahead of the Senate in getting things done. And and yet, at the same time, the GOP made her a lightning rod in the elections. I think that every time a candidate was running for office, they'd include Nancy Pelosi's name in order to trash their opponent. I think that the problem with Nancy Pelosi has been that she doesn't come across very well on camera or on the media. It's like style points. I was thinking about an effective speaker that was good on camera was Tip O'Neill. And I just wondered what your guest thinks about that, that America is so caught up in people coming across well on camera and the news and things, and she came across as a little different. Part of it is that she's the first woman speaker. Maybe part of it is that she's just the way she is, her nature from Northern California. At any rate, I'd be interested in hearing your views on it.
It's not a Northern California trait, I can tell you that. There are plenty of Northern Californians, politicians, who, the most dangerous place to stand is between them and a camera, and you wouldn't say that about Nancy Pelosi. I mean, there's both a good and a bad to it. The bad, and, I covered her for close to 2 decades as a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and I probably got along with her as well as any reporter, and we didn't really get along at all. I mean, we got along professionally beautifully, but she is known among members of Congress and among Democratic donors as being among the most thoughtful and gracious and detail-oriented, warm politicians there are, not to the media, not necessarily to her staff. It's just not the way she is. She clams up when she goes on camera. She looks at the media as a tool in her bag. They're there to convey the message. And, I mean, a lot of politicians, sometimes it's sincere and sometimes it's complete fake. You're their good friend and they warm up to the media. She never did that. She has always been a distance. And believe it or not, what you see on TV now is a big improvement over what she was like a decade ago. She's actually gotten much better. But interviewing Nancy Pelosi is often like reading a press release. You get talking points. And she's not, clearly she thinks well beyond that. She's a very, very bright woman. She can be very articulate. But with the press, she's very stiff. There is a good element to that tactically for the Democrats in that she does not have the typical political, I dare say, male ego when it comes to this. She really is not someone who needs to stand in front of the camera and take credit. And what that means is when somebody like John Murtha, who's now dead, congressman, a good friend of hers from Pennsylvania, conservative hawk, who big supporter of the war in Iraq, when he came out with a plan to say that Iraq, we need to end the war. It was a big turning point. Finally, a hawk was saying, this is a terrible mistake. She was very careful to stay out of the limelight. I remember that day she had her weekly press conference, and everyone wanted to say, what do you think about Murtha? What do you think about Murtha? She knew that if she said, well, of course I support what Murtha said, the headline would be, San Francisco Democrat supports Murtha, and somehow she would be mixed in it. She stood there in front of the camera and said, oh, well, that's Mr. Murtha's plan. I don't really have any comment. It was ridiculous. Of course she had thoughts about it. She was behind it. But she stood there in front of the camera looking like a deer caught in the headlights, but it was a very tactical thing she did. She did that so the headline the next day would be about the grizzled Marine from Pennsylvania who is now against the war. So there's some real advantage to that. But, boy, that the weakness she has as a communicator, it has definitely been a problem.
Well, Rick kind of raised the point that Nancy Pelosi became kind of the whipping boy, if I can use that term, about her for the Republican Party, for the right wing media machine, certainly for the Tea Party. She became kind of the image of a whole bunch of things that people were either angry about or afraid of. And I think I saw one number that she was negatively targeted in something like 160,000 different ads across the country in this last election cycle. Certainly nobody else was mentioned that often. Why was that? Why did she become such a polarizing image in American politics?
Well, you guys even have that. I mean, in Wisconsin, I know that your incoming governor used it in a governor's race of all things. You know, to go after Mark Newman. Scott Walker had ads that, you know, tried to tie Newman in with Nancy Pelosi. Was it something like, remind you of anybody? And then Nancy Pelosi's face would pop up. This is actually interesting because they've done this for a long time, they meaning the Republicans, and it has been completely ineffective until this year, in part because for a long time people didn't really know who Nancy Pelosi was. And as much as they tried to portray her as this wide-eyed, crazy San Franciscan, she would show up on Letterman or other kind of national appearances as the, you know, Italian grandmother, which you also is, and those things are not in. You can be a wide-eyed liberal Italian grandmother all at once. It's just a matter of how you look at it. There's a subtle difference, which I think is actually kind of it speaks to her legacy. In the old ads, it was always San Francisco values they talked about. Do you want San Francisco values, you know, down in Mississippi? Well, don't vote for this Democrat because he's going to be supporting a speaker with San Francisco values. Now, you can read a lot into what that means. Pelosi always thought it meant, you know, sort of San Francisco's gay and lesbian reputation and, you know, people with piercings in their various body parts standing in line to get married. And that's the image that people wanted to convey with San Francisco values. There may have been a lot more to it. I mean, San Francisco is clearly one of the most liberal spots in the country. This time the ads were different. There was some of that, but for the most part, she was just the face of government. People hate Congress right now. They hate big business. They hated Republicans when they were in office. They hate Democrats now that they're in office. They hate the status quo and the powers that be. To the extent that she is the face of Congress, it was very effective to put her face up there. Often it was right beside Barack Obama. Her staff is still convinced, and I've talked to them about this, that there is some inherent sexism involved in this. I don't see that anymore. I think she is the face of the establishment, and the fact that she's the face of the establishment says an awful lot about her legacy, because what it means is the face of the establishment is now a woman from San Francisco.
Let's. I want to talk about the whole legacy thing for the rest of the hour, if we can. But first, I'm going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with more with Mark Sandilow, who is my guest this hour. We're talking about the legacy. What will Nancy Pelosi be remembered for as the Speaker of the House? She was the first woman to hold that office in the history of the United States Congress, and that's pretty significant. Wondering what you think. 800-642-1234. What do you think Nancy Pelosi will be remembered for as a Speaker of the House? Would love to have your opinion on that. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or find the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page, and you can reach us there as well. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 9:46, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stick around, because after 10, my guest, who is best known for his work on the development of net neutrality theory, has a new book that chronicles the turning points of the last century's information landscape. Should be a pretty interesting hour. The title of the book is The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Tim Wu will be my guest after 10 o'clock this morning. This hour, we're talking about the legacy of the current Speaker of the House, who won't be the Speaker of the House anymore in a little over a week. And we're trying to put a little frame around this and say, okay, what will Nancy Pelosi be remembered for as the Speaker of the House of Representatives? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. My guest, Mark Sandilow, who is the author of a biography of Nancy Pelosi titled Madam Speaker, The Life, Times, and Rise of Nancy Pelosi. Let's take a call. We'll go to Madison and hear what Ann has to say this morning. Ann, good morning.
Good morning. I grew up not too far from Baltimore, and I remember just vaguely, you know, from my childhood, D'Alessandro's name all over the Washington Post, and my parents talked about him every now and then, too, so... You know, he was a big wheel in those days. And I think that although Nancy Pelosi is She's very subtle, a subtle politician. You can imagine maybe the opposite of Wisconsin's governor-elect Scott Walker, who's come out with a saber just slashing right and left and in the limelight even before he became governor. She's very, very effective. She's done great things for women, and I really like her in that respect, but I think she did grave damage and almost final damage to America's small-d democratic form of government when practically the first thing she said when the Democrats gained control of Congress was impeachment is off the table. And I don't think it had to be impeachment of Bush and then Cheney. I mean, there could have been a double impeachment because everybody had the feeling that Cheney was the brains behind the what Bush did. But I think even if it hadn't been successful, as basically the idiotic impeachment of Clinton for nothing wasn't successful, I think not to do it was, I think that was almost fatal. And there's where I think practical politics can be a big mistake.
You know, just to point out that had they been successful in impeaching the president and the vice president, who becomes president? You know, the number two in the chain of command happens to be the Speaker of the House. Well, I guess that what I was going to say with Pelosi, that would have been Dennis Hastert at that point. The calculation was that they had other things they wanted to do, and if you just look at what they pulled off when she became Speaker, I guess it wasn't Hastert, but if they'd impeached him successfully, she would have been Speaker, she would have become President. You know, the media, it would have been very, very hard to portray this as an objective, you know, just let the facts fall where they were, when you have the Speaker coming in who immediately is clearing out proceedings that would put her in the Commander-in-Chief seat. The first couple things they did when she was Speaker, they increased the minimum wage. They passed legislation guaranteeing equal pay for women. They passed an S-CHIP bill to extend, you know, health care for poor children. They changed fuel efficiency standards in automobiles. What Pelosi thought was, if we go the impeachment route, that doesn't get done. The nation will be consumed with a very partisan discussion instead. And just like Ann suggests, there were a lot of voters out there who were actually outraged by that, because the other side of it is, you know, if you believe that George Bush led us on false pretenses into an illegal war, well, then what consequences are there for future presidents if you don't even bother to hold them accountable for that?
Well, let's talk about some of the legislative accomplishments that Nancy Pelosi may be remembered for. I would think the two most obvious ones would be the health care bill and financial reform.
No question. I think that, you know, financial reform is so complicated that most Americans are clueless. Most journalists are clueless about what the change will be, although it has addressed some of the concerns, at least a few of them, from the financial collapse and what Wall Street did over the last few years. I mean, the health care bill is clearly the shining moment of her legacy, in part because were it not for her leadership style, it wouldn't have happened. If you remember, the House had passed a bill, and in fact, the House had even passed a public option bill, sort of the more liberal version of it, but it wasn't going to happen in the Senate. And then when Ted Kennedy's seat was taken up by a Republican, it looked as if health care might be dead, and it looked like President Obama might abandon the more ambitious plan and simply go for something far, far more modest. And it was Pelosi behind the scenes who said, you can't do that. You know, my members have already stuck their necks out this far. You're not going to set them up to be creamed in the election for having done this and not even get a bill passed. And it's complicated. This is the messy sausage-making part of legislation, because you had a group of Democrats who weren't going to vote for this because of what they thought was federal money going to abortions. You had another group of liberal Democrats who weren't going to vote for it because it wasn't going to contain a public option. You had fiscally conservative Democrats who weren't going to vote for it because it cost too much. She had to find a way to satisfy all of them, and it worked. I mean, she passed a bill, and it's signed, and it's not even close to what the left had wanted to accomplish. That said, you know, by 2014, all Americans will be required to carry health insurance, which is a fundamental change.
Let's take a call from Stephen's Point next. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. may seem like a silly question, but I just want to know if any Speaker of the House is remembered for anything at all, ever. Not particularly demeaning to Nancy Pelosi, but looking back at my history classes in high school and in college, I don't remember any talk of any Speaker of the House anywhere. So just wondering if this conversation is even worth it.
Thanks for the call,
good,
Steve.
Good question, and humbling to somebody who wrote a biography of the current speaker. It's a legitimate point. I mean, if you live in Washington, you have a warped view of how important this stuff is and how much America knows about it or cares about it. There are some speakers throughout history who have been memorable. I mean, people of my generation certainly remember Tip O'Neill, just because he was the counterpoint to Ronald Reagan. But if you walked down even the streets of Washington and said, you know, name one, let alone two things that Tip O'Neill accomplished, you would get blank stares. I mean, the famous speakers throughout history have buildings named after them. There's Sam Rayburn from Texas, and the Rayburn Building was named after him. And, you know, Joe Cannon, Longworth. There are some famous names in the past. They're remembered.
McCormick would be another one.
McCormick is another one right from Massachusetts. Strong, powerful politicians, but not necessarily remembered for any specific piece of legislation. So you may be right that we're fooling ourselves to think that Nancy Pelosi and health care will, throughout history, be synonymous. But I do think she will. I mean, she's got buildings named after her, and Republicans are going to hate it. Because she, I mean, if nothing else, the gender difference is a transformative moment in politics. I mean, think of how, when I wrote this book, I talked to a number of women who came to Congress just over the last 20 or 30 years. Pat Schroeder from Colorado tells the story of when she first sat down in her committee. The committee chairman, this is in the early 70s, he didn't like having a woman on his committee, and there was an African-American, Ron Delms from Berkeley, who was elected as well. He didn't like having a black guy on his committee, and they both were against the Vietnam War, and he couldn't stand it. So he said, I may, as chairman, not be able to control who serves on my committee, but I do control how many chairs there are. He made Pat Schroeder and Ron Delms literally sit cheek to cheek, sharing a single chair for their first hearing. And the thing that amazes me about that is not that we have one sort of redneck from Louisiana Democrat who would do that, but that no one on the committee stood up to complain. People have come a long way. It took Wisconsin 150 years in the Republic to elect the very first woman to the House of Representatives, you know, Tammy Baldwin. The country has always thought of political leaders as men, and that's no longer true to the same extent. And Nancy Pelosi, no one has changed that image more than Nancy Pelosi.
Well, perhaps that will be what she is remembered for, as being the first woman to attain that level of power in the federal government, instead of rather than a piece of legislation, but for being a trailblazer, somebody who maybe opened some doors. As she said, she cracked the marble ceiling in Washington, D.C. Perhaps that will be her legacy.
And this tough behind-the-scenes thing I've been talking about, that's an important part of it because, I mean, people who follow the news have seen these clips of John Boehner, the incoming speaker, weeping at a few moments during interviews. And, you know, I see nothing wrong with that. But I do know politically that if Nancy Pelosi had started weeping and saying that she can't go to a school these days because when she sees small children, she tears up, which is what Boehner said, forget it. It would start raising questions about, you know, are women, do they have the hormonal balance to be able to pull this off? Can they really get tough? You know, Lyndon Johnson was a leader in the Congress because he could yell at people. Sam Rayburn knew how to twist arms. What could a woman do? Well, Nancy Pelosi has answered those questions. A woman can be just as tough and backroom operator as a man can be. And I do think that ultimately that ends up being her legacy.
Well, there's a price that has to be paid for that as well, though, and I think Hillary Clinton also found that out.
There are no question. That's true. I don't know if Hillary Clinton lost because she was a woman or lost because Barack Obama captured the moment far better. But, I mean, you know, Secretary, the role that women play in Washington today is still limited, but there is almost no one who looks at even Hillary Clinton now and says, well, she's not a very good Secretary of State because she's a woman. It's outside the realm. It's not on the radar screen anymore. And you don't have to look back very long. I mean, really, one generation to remember when that was not the case. And the next generation will, because of people like Nancy Pelosi, won't even understand why that was an issue.
And I think we can leave it there. We're out of time anyway, so we'll have to. That's the way these radio shows go. There's a time limit. Thank you, Mark Sandilow, for spending this enlightening hour with us.
Thank you.
Mark Sandilow is author of Madam Speaker, The Life, Times, and Rise of Nancy Pelosi. He's Associate Academic Director at the University of California's Washington Center and editor of the California News Service. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. Thank you, Rhonda, for rounding up a great guest for me again this morning. And Erica Janik handled on-air production. Stick around. After 10 o'clock this morning, we'll be talking about the book, The Master Switch, and maybe some insights into the future of the Internet based on how other information technologies have been handled. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network.